Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. We are very, very excited. Why, Alex, are we so excited? Who have we got that's so awesome today?
Well, we've got some guy who people may have heard waffling on down the pub at some point. We have Jonathan W. Jordan with us. So he's been on before talking about the Texas Navy and War Queens, which he wrote with his daughter. But he's a pretty outstanding historian in his own right, without Emily's help. It's like award-winning books and best-selling books like American Warlords, which is about Roosevelt's high command and victory in World War II, and Brothers, Rivals, Victors, which is about Eisenhower, Patton and Bradley. But he's come on today. Basically, we are his soapbox today because we have been laughing our heads off about the absolute nonsense coming out of Washington in the last few days, haven't we, John?
Oh, it's been quite a show.
Yeah, it's been hilarious. But what you want to say today is essentially, you think this shit's bad. This is nothing new in American politics.
Yeah, we're gonna. I was. We're gonna go back to the good old days when everything was nice and we had high-minded founding fathers who stood up, wrote declarations, and shit marble.
Yeah.
But what we find out is the good old days were not so much different from where they are today, in some respects at least.
Yes, we are looking at ugly politics during the era of the founding fathers. So, can you define for us then what Democrats and Republicans were in the late 1700s? Because it's not what they are now, is it?
It's not. Back in the late 1700s, and we're talking really starting about 1794 to 1796, and up through the early 1800s, you had two main factions. You started out with the Democratic Republicans, led by Thomas Jefferson. They tended to be the rural party of the South. They were in favor of states' rights. And although their name is Democratic Republicans, they are a lot more like the modern Republicans you see today, the party of that's based more in the South, party that is more of a rural party, and the party of smaller government. But the Democratic Republicans ironically morphed into the Democratic Party eventually, and we'll get to that in a few minutes. The monarchical northern the manufacturing-based New York type political party was the Federalist Party, and they tended to be the party in favor of a strong central government. And this was at a time when there was a genuine debate as to whether we were a collection of sovereign states or whether we were headed by a strong central government and in what way we should do that. So the Federalists and the Republicans were the first two groups to start splitting into parties. Before then, the part there were really no parties. Remember, we started off with President George Washington in 1792, and he was a single person. Everybody could rally around him. There really were no defined parties, at least overtly at that time. And George Washington kept preaching the gospel of no factions, no parties. We should all be for the United States as a whole. But of course, eventually the groups had different philosophies of government, ideas of the French Revolution, and or the British monarchy took hold, and those influenced the parties that became the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans.
So when we talk about elections back then, they don't look exactly like what they do now, do they?
No, they were run by slightly different rules. In some ways, they were similar. You had states that voted for electors, so it was not a pure democracy. Whoever gets the most number of votes wins. On the other hand, you did it differently back then. You'd vote for your top choice for president, and whoever got the most votes became president, and electoral votes. And whoever got the second number of electoral votes became vice president. Well, as we know from modern experience, typically the two opposing candidates get the top two votes, and it's usually a two-party runoff. That's pretty much the way it's always done here. But the problem, of course, is that that means that the two opponents are most likely to have to serve together. So that would be the equivalent if in 2016, Donald Trump was elected president and Hillary Clinton was elected his vice president. And that was a flaw in the constitutional system that was not apparent during the nice old George Washington days, but became apparent once there were organized parties that started campaigning against each other.
So when was the first contested election and what happened?
The first election that we really get into contested in any sense of the word is the 1796 election. That pitted Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson against Vice President John Adams. Both men had served faithfully in George Washington's cabinet. Both of them were personally loyal to Washington. But in 1796, Washington said, I'm finishing up my second term. I'm not going to run for a third term. Washington did that in one of those great statesman-like moments where he concluded that if the president does not outlive his tenure, if the person does not outlive the office that he serves, then that's a bad thing for the country. We don't want presidents to die in office because that creates transitional problems. So he stepped aside, and Jefferson, who was influenced by the French model of republicanism, he was the ambassador to France, he was a populist sort of from Virginia, he was a champion of the farmers and the South and what was eventually going to be a growing West. He ran against John Adams, who was from Quincy, Massachusetts. Adams was a Federalist and had believed in a strong central government. It was needed to put down things like internal insurrections, such as a revolt against the tax on whiskey that had occurred in 2 years earlier. He was a believer in a strong central executive, a strong president. And so these two conflicting philosophies went head to head against each other. Now, as historians have pointed out, back in 1796, this kind of republic didn't have much of a blueprint. There was very little empirical data that would tell Jefferson or Adams, here's why I'm right. They all had theories. They read the writings of the French philosophes. They looked at their own experiences, and they had these political beliefs that were largely untested. And because they were untested, each side pretty much had to go with their gut. And that election became a very close and very ugly election. In that election, John Adams squeaked by, winning by 3 electoral votes over Thomas Jefferson. However, in that election, there were 3 candidates who were really viable candidates for the presidency: Adams, Jefferson, and then a third guy from South Carolina, who Alexander Hamilton had secretly campaigned for, on the idea that that Adams, who he personally disliked, who Hamilton personally disliked, and Jefferson.
I was going to say, did he write a song about it? But no.
Yeah, I was about to say, yeah, Hamilton is the Broadway star right now, and we see in that brilliant musical, the animosity between Hamilton and Jefferson. Hamilton was a Federalist; he worked faithfully for George Washington. He did not like Adams. Adams was a New England man. Hamilton was an immigrant New Yorker. And the two of them did not get along. So even though they were part of the same party, you had Hamilton secretly working on the side of a third party guy who might be able to knock Adams out of the way, but more importantly, might likely keep Jefferson from gaining enough votes to become president. It turned into a squeaker, as I said. Adams ended up winning slightly, but during this time, a precedent was set for a lot of mudslinging, a lot of ugliness that would become more pronounced as the 18th century ended and the 19th century began.
I want to know, how did the press react during all of this?
Well, even before the election, both the Federalists and the either anti-Federalists or budding Democratic-Republican group had their own partisan papers. Jefferson, early on, around 1794, 1795, hired a French translator clerk in his State Department to publish anti-Federalist articles in the National Gazette. Alexander Hamilton funded the Gazette of the United States. And in these newspapers, they would start, they would just bash each other in the press. In fact, that's one of the lines from Hamilton, the musical: we bash each other in the press and we don't print retractions. And that's really what they were doing. You had people like Thomas Paine, who famously wrote the pamphlet Common Sense during the Revolutionary War. And he was a Jefferson partisan. They would basically talk about the scandalous acts, the dangerous ideas, the avarice, the vice, every one of the seven deadly sins practically you could come up with, they would charge the other candidate with.
What's some of the ridiculous shit that they accuse each other of?
Oh, well, they and this actually becomes a later iterations had one person from a pro-Jeffersonian who wrote for the Philadelphia Aurora. He was the editor and publisher. He described President Adams as the querulous, bald, blind, crippling, toothless Adams. Meanwhile, you had Jefferson being accused in Federalist pamphlets of atheism, of being a libertine, of being a Jacobin, a shameless debtor as a farmer. He was an advocate of states' rights over the Constitution, and rumors had it he was sleeping with some of his slave women, which, as it turns out, actually did.
This is like no better than the shit they chuck at each other now, is it?
Oh, absolutely. So Adams comes across as this, as I said, bald, toothless, incompetent grump. He was called a madman, a monarchist, corrupt, insane. He was even accused of sending Charles Pinckney, a diplomat, over to England to fetch two wenches for himself and two wenches for Pinckney. So he was basically sex trafficking is what the charge was. Adams actually just told one of his friends, a former law partner, as far as that last charge of Pinckney picking up four prostitutes, "I declare upon my honor, if this is true, then General Pinckney has kept them all four to himself and cheated me out of my two." He had a sense of humor about it, but it was an extremely nasty set of charges that went back and forth. And it really personalized campaigning. The ideas started to take, in some ways, a backseat to just how much negative press could you throw at your opponent.
Okay, so this is okay. They've learned this is new, this election thing. They'll grow as people. When they come back next time, they'll know how to behave, right, in 1800?
Absolutely. They cleaned up their act, and it was a happy time. Now, the election
is that a lie?
Yeah. The election of 1800 resulted in a lethal duel, the almost permanent fracturing of a longtime friendship between founding fathers, and a constitutional amendment. That's how bad it became.
Oh,
now,
my God.
At the time, there was actually, there were concerns that New England would secede from the Union if Jefferson were elected. And David McCullough, the brilliant historian, wrote that the election of 1800 became a contest of personal vilification surpassing any presidential election in American history. And whether Adams or Jefferson was the most abused would be hard to say. It was one of those just ugly times that was symptomatic of what we see now. It was a close election. It was one that ended up going to the House of Representatives. It ended up becoming such a bitter personality contest. And in the end, Congress realized that there were constitutional flaws in our process. After Jefferson was ultimately elected. They changed the Constitution and provided that from now on, instead of having the one person, whoever gets the most votes becomes president, number two becomes vice president, that you would vote separately for president and vice president. So you could have essentially the two parties putting their own slate up, and we vote for them together nowadays. So the election of 1800 really didn't do anybody any favors. Ultimately, famously, Alexander Hamilton and the runner-up to the election, Aaron Burr, a New Yorker, were so angry with each other over the result that they met at a duel that resulted in Alexander Hamilton's death. The friendship between John Adams, who ended up third, and Thomas Jefferson had started back during their early Revolutionary War days. These are the two men who collaborated on the Declaration of Independence, one of the most beautifully written document, political documents in history. They had been fast friends. They had been they met each other overseas in England briefly when they were both serving as diplomats in the early Republic. But that 1800 election was so bitter, so divisive between the two, that it resulted in the fracture of their friendship that did not resume until after Jefferson's tenure as president had ended. Part of the reason for that, for the viciousness, or one of the results, I should say, of the viciousness of the press charges back and forth during that time period, was the so-called Sedition Act. It was a law passed under John Adams. He didn't draft the act, but he did sign it. And it provided that there would be criminal penalties for speaking or publishing any false, malicious, or scandalous writings against the United States government or Congress with the intent to bring them into contempt or disrepute. The idea was that the press had gotten so out of hand, so partisan, and had been throwing so much fake news at the electorate that we're actually going to set criminal penalties for political speech, which was an early embarrassment to our republic. And in fact, the guy who wrote that op-ed in the Philadelphia Aurora describing President Adams as querulous, bald, blind, crippled, and toothless, he was one of the first people arrested under that act. So that's kind of where we were. We think of CNN and Fox News in the United States as being the two hyper-partisan news outlets, but they had nothing compared to the National Gazette, the Gazette of the United States, and the other papers of the time.
Does this stop them getting involved?
No. They that's the thing. They just continued, and eventually Congress repealed the Sedition Act. It also repealed the its companion act, the Alien Act, which was basically there to keep Irish out of the country. It changed the time to become a U.S. citizen from 5 years to 14 years, and the Irish at that time hated the British, which of course is very different today, and they generally voted Republican, which of course is the same that they do today. So. And I'm being sarcastic in both of those, but the idea was that we had such unrest in the country, so many threats of insurrection and rebellion, and there was so much nasty politicizing going on that Congress actually quelled freedom of speech and did a lot of dirty things just to kind of tamp down on it.
I'm curious to know, were there any elections in this time period that just didn't involve chaos like this?
Alina, when we get past the election of 1800, the one good thing that came out of that time period was it basically settled the political question. For the elections of 1796 and 1800, it had been a real horse race between the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans. The elections were close, very narrowly decided, and either side could tip the balance. But with Jefferson's election in 1800 and his re-election in 1804, that more or less settled the question and put the Democratic Republicans in charge. After Jefferson's election, then you had James Madison and James Monroe, two Democratic Republicans who were elected. They had both served as allies to Thomas Jefferson. They were all Virginians, and this set a time period up until about the War of 1812 and a little afterward, actually, where the Democratic Republicans were in charge and things were a little bit quieter. So the elections were pretty much settled affairs more or less. Until we get to, say, around the time of Andrew Jackson in the mid-1820s.
Before we get to that, can I ask a question? You know there's the limit of two terms. No one can be president more than twice, can they? Or four-year terms.
That's correct.
Is that because of foresight right at the beginning and that was always the way? Or is it because someone was a dick and they wanted to make sure it didn't happen again?
That's a good question, Alex. At the time, it was a tradition. Nobody, because of the precedent George Washington set, every president until Franklin Delano Roosevelt honored that precedent, and there was no need for a law to be passed.
Yeah.
Now, with FDR in 1940, Britain was at war, Europe was at war, Asia was at war. The United States implemented its first ever peacetime draft, and we were facing a crisis. And Franklin Roosevelt, who was enormously popular, said, and I think there's some truth to that. He said, look, the soldier on the front line doesn't get to say when he goes home. And while I think Roosevelt genuinely could not resist pulling the levers of power, he also had a decent case to make to the American public that this was a crisis that was unprecedented and he needed to be the one to manage it. So he ran for president in 1940 and was elected. He was reelected in 1944, his health was going. And then after that, we amended the Constitution to provide that there would be a two-term limit on presidents. So I wouldn't call Franklin Roosevelt necessarily a dick, but he did disregard that time-honored tradition.
Go back on track a little bit. He becomes the seventh president, doesn't he, in 1828?
He did, and for the 1828 election, it was actually a rematch of the previous election. So you start off with basically a split between the Northerners and Southerners, reflected in the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans. But then once the Democratic Republicans run everything, they start to factionalize themselves. And so you had John Quincy Adams, who won in 1824. He was the son of John Adams. Now, John Adams was a Federalist, but John Quincy Adams was kind of a Northern Democrat. And during the election of 1824, Adams went against Andrew Jackson. And the election went into the House of Representatives because there was Jackson actually won the popular vote, but he did not get a majority of the electoral votes, the votes cast by the states. And as a result, the House of Representatives ended up electing John Quincy Adams with the help of some anti-Jackson guys who just really hated him. So they did a rematch in 1828, and at that time between 1824 and 1828, the old Democratic Republican Party fell apart, and it became basically, do you like Adams or do you like Jackson? It was a lot like the 2016 election, where that was driven as much by personality as by policy. So it became essentially the Jackson versus anti-Jackson parties. In 1828, during the rematch, it became set a new level for mudslinging. And a good part of it was really focused on the personal qualities of each candidate. Jackson was had lived a very colorful life. He had been a young kind of teenage soldier in the Revolutionary War. He'd been wounded by a British saber. He defeated the British at the Battle of New Orleans in 1815. He had owned slaves. He had married a woman who they thought was divorced, but it turned out the paperwork hadn't finished and been finalized. So he ended up having to remarry her, and that caused a scandal at the time. Jackson, as a military leader, had also had people, you know, shot or hanged for desertion and things like that. So all that became fodder for the anti-Jackson candidates. And in the end, the mud was slung at Jackson, but he was so popular as kind of a Southerner, a Westerner, a populist, and a war hero that he ended up taking the election pretty handily on the electoral vote count. He basically got every state except the New England states, but that was another setting where you just had a lot of mud being slung at each other, and basically they were, it was bitterly contested as well. Once he was elected, his followers were called the King Mob, and the idea was these are basically a bunch of Western anarchists who were like going nuts. After the inauguration, a mob of his followers basically swarmed the White House, and they ended up knocking furniture over. It was just basically a big, it was a big mass crowd and just clusterfuck for the inauguration in March of 1829. And, the furniture was knocked over, things were broken. Jackson had to go out the back door to kind of get away from the crowd. And so, the conservatives from the anti-Jackson group called that King Mob said that the King Mob was basically ruling and you're not going to have an organized government under Jackson. He actually had a fairly successful couple of terms in office and did well as our seventh president.
It's just, you've got all this to look forward to next week.
Oh yeah, exactly. Hopefully security will be a little bit tighter, and at least with the Capitol Hill area, there's more room to move around and knock over punch bowls and furniture. So we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, it will have happened, I think, by the time this podcast goes out, can chuckle about it all. But so let's go to another sort of founding father. Does he count as a founding father? But Abraham Lincoln, he's a grown up. He's a sensible man. Let's go to his election in 1860. Surely this giant of American history, when he became 16th president of America, his election campaign was all very trite and well-behaved, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. This was the easy one that really, people overlooked because it was just something that didn't really matter too much.
No, this is sarcasm, isn't it? Because shit show.
It became there are very few times when you can say an election destroyed a country. And while the United States survived the aftermath of the 1860 election, it was the election was one that that really set the stage for our lowest time in history.
So it basically is in part responsible for the American Civil War, is what you're saying?
Yes, and very, very much in part. Now, a moment ago, we talked about Andrew Jackson. He was a Westerner. He was the guy who kind of, exemplified the New South, the man of the West, and that was when Tennessee and Kentucky were considered Western states. The West grew after Jackson's administration. Andrew Jackson was a unionist. He believed in expanding the United States of America under a fairly strong central government. And although he did not provoke a war with Mexico, his successors did. And James K. Polk, the president, sort of got us into the U.S.-Mexican War in 1848. And that war resulted in an American victory and the acquisition of territory from the Texas border, Texas western border, because Texas had already joined the United States in 1846, all the way to California and Colorado and Utah and those Rocky Mountain states. So the United States brought in a massive amount of territory, but the lingering problem that America had for expansion was the slavery question. That had been something that the founding fathers struggled with, and they knew in their minds that it would only become a problem that got worse and worse because the slave population would get bigger and bigger. The North tended to be abolitionist and believed that slavery was immoral, evil, and uneconomical. The South held on to its institution of slavery, and it, because it used a lot of slaves in its farming, particularly its cotton crops. So the country began fracturing, and as new states were added in the aftermath of the Mexican War, the two parties knew that if they had a slave state, that would add to their political power or subtract to their political power. So the question of slavery became worse and worse, and it degenerated under the mediocre presidents that led up to the 1860 election. In the 1860 election, Abraham Lincoln, who a Republican, and the Republicans at this point were the anti-slavery Northerners, ran against John Breckinridge of Kentucky. He was a Southern Democratic candidate. And Lincoln ended up winning a decisive electoral vote. He carried 18 states. Breckinridge carried 11 states. So the states were clearly split. And because of that, in fact, you could almost look at the Civil War and tell who's going to be on the North, who's going to be in the South, and who's a border state by who voted for Lincoln, who voted for either Breckinridge or, and Douglas, Stephen Douglas, a Democratic candidate. And then and who voted for, the third candidate, John Bell. So you've got, you had a very highly divided country. Lincoln was considered to be an ugly man. He was lampooned as an ape, even by people who would serve in his cabinet. He was considered to be sort of a country lawyer hick from back out, back in the backwoods. He made a big deal about his log cabin and rural background. He was actually a very, very intelligent lawyer. He was a good trial lawyer, and he tended to, he was a very good commercial lawyer as well in the disputes between the big railroad companies and the big steamship companies. So you had Lincoln as sort of this candidate who was going to be considered, not personally a very, it was a good target for personal attacks, but more to the point, the country was a tinderbox ready to explode. And the 1860 election was essentially the last straw for Southerners. Shortly after the election of Lincoln, South Carolina seceded from the Union. It was followed by a number of other states, Alabama, Georgia, and then when Lincoln decided that was worthy of calling up volunteers for the army to suppress the insurrection, then other states such as Virginia followed. So it became a real turning point, which, like the election of 1800, eventually settled things for a long time. And it was sort of a cathartic moment. It was horrifying, but at least it did settle the slavery question and took it off the table. It, of course, did not take other things like racism, political oppression, and other things like that off the table. But at least it got the question of race, of slavery, which had been lingering since the founding of the Republic, dealt with. So, yes, it became another shit show for America.
I'm curious to know, out of all, because we've spoken about a couple of elections here, of all of these completely chaotic elections, which one for you is probably the most important?
Well, obviously, when your election results in a civil war, that is the most, you know, that's the one that's going to have the most impact in many ways. But taking war aside, if you just say, let's talk about this as a political discussion, I think it would have to be the election of 1800, because it firmly established the idea that A, we can have a two-party system, B, we can have a period where one party is dominant for a long time, and there will be opposition parties that kind of pick at them until they can coalesce and form their own party. That, and then, of course, it mechanically set the process of the way, changing the way we voted for president. So you would not have in the year 2021, President Joe Biden sworn in right before Vice President Donald Trump is sworn in.
This has been brilliant, because I think we have just about proven that, although granted nobody in any of your stories was wearing a Chewbacca bikini and horns.
I'm obsessed with that guy.
I know. I can't believe they're indulging his organic diet. I feed him Cheetos and let him
He's used to feeding prairie grass with his herd on the range.
What a dick. Do you anticipate, I'm going to be interested because this would have happened by now, do you think they have a handle on the inauguration next week? Do you think we're now seeing the end of this utter carnage that has been the 2020 election?
Yes and no. I think they do have a handle on the inaugural. It's going to be a peaceful event. It will probably be accompanied by demonstrations of different sorts. So, you know, how you characterize it, whether it's a protest or an insurrection or, you know, whatever it is, I think there's going to be some of that. But there will, I don't think there's going to be anything that directly affects the inauguration. No to the question, have we seen the end of the chaos of the 2020 election? My belief is that each side looks at the nasty thing the other side does and does about 10% more when it's their turn. And we've been going down this road for some time, since the 2000 election, in fact, when that was a very close election between George Bush and Al Gore. It had to be settled. It had to be settled by the U.S. Supreme Court after it came down to a 570 vote difference in the state of Florida. After that, slogans like "Not My President" began percolating into the mainstream, and the idea of, "Well, I didn't vote for the son of a bitch, but he's my president," is that seems to be something that we are losing. And the nastiness of today's elections is a little different from the nastiness of the elections in the early days of the Republic, because back in the early days of the Republic, you flung your mud at the candidate, and you might even fling your mud at some of his inner circle, but basically that's who got the mud flung at him. But because of the internet, because of politics becoming a spectator sport, the mud is starting to be thrown at a broader series of targets. So if you worked in the Trump administration and you're eating in a restaurant, it's okay for us to get a mob to kind of, you know, scream you out of the restaurant. And it's okay to get on the on Twitter and castigate any person who supported the person you don't like. And so that level of nastiness that we saw in the 1800s, which was limited to, by and large, the president and their supporters or the candidate, is now filtering deeper into the fabric of our society and is becoming closer to a social conflict rather than a purely political conflict. And that's what I am concerned about. And it's going to be our challenge to find a way to reverse that trend if we're going to be stronger going forward.
I want to say thank you so much. That was so insightful. And for the first time, I got excited about American history. So thank you very much for that.
For the first time, that's harsh.
I was hoping to go into about an hour of how the Roosevelt administration limited the the import and immigration of Jews who were escaping the Holocaust and those who were trying to get away from Auschwitz. But, you know, I couldn't find a way to work it in.
Another time we will do
another
that.
Another time, yes.
No, I do. I'm lying. I'm not. It's not the first time, guys. It's been quite a few times, but I was captivated. John, you can talk any time for me. You know, I'm captivated by everything you say.
You're very, very kind, Delina. And look, these are always fun to do.
Join us tomorrow when we will be learning all about Mary the First. That's Bloody Mary, because we spoke to Johanna Strong, who specializes in the historiography of Mary the First, which is really interesting because it turns out that history hasn't necessarily been fair to her, and we'll find out why. So don't miss out on that. Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as a dollar a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year. We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there and we have our own channel and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. So do go over there and subscribe.